We're just a few days away from the anniversary of Swami Kriyananda's passing. It's Tuesday night, and we'll have a special program here, meditation first at 5 o'clock, and then at 7:30, a special program dedicated to him. And then a few weeks later, the weekend of the 16th of May, they'll be dedicating the shrine at Ananda Village that has been built, where his body will be placed in a little meditation temple. It's really an extraordinary building, extraordinary memorial that's been put together for him. And all of you who possibly can should go up there for that, at least for one day of that dedication. I'll talk on Tuesday night, but I will also talk a little today about this anniversary. Swami died at 8:30 in the morning in Italy, so it was 11 o'clock at night in America. And we received a phone call, first just right at 11, that Swami was having, quote, having trouble breathing. And a couple of minutes later, literally, we got a phone call that said he was gone. So even though he was 86 and his health was always precarious, his actual passing just came like that. I mean, literally, he got up. He was sitting waiting for breakfast. He had a spasm through his body just unexpectedly. And basically, he left at that point. He breathed intermittently for about 15 more minutes, but he left at that moment. It's been a very interesting couple of years. I met Swami in 1969, and have been in a continuous relationship with him ever since then. So there was a lot more years when he was on the planet than when he wasn't. These 2 years have been very strange in a certain sense, because on a certain level it feels like he's been gone forever. I just can't believe it's only 2 years. It feels like 15, 20. It's a very strange sense of time. Otherwise, 2 years goes by in a heartbeat and you don't even notice it. It's somehow his consciousness, because it lives outside of this plane, it plays tricks on this reality. I guess part of it is he would only come through this area intermittently. So there's still this little piece of me that just thinks, you know, tomorrow we'll be fixing up his room and buying the groceries and planning his meals. Death is a very peculiar thing at all times. My mother is gone, my father is gone. You know, someone is there completely and then they're not. People like my parents, who were good people, but not, of course, saints. I was in Europe when my mother died, and I had been responsible for her care. She was not in my home. She was being taken care of in a place that she lived in Southern California with my father. And I left on a Sunday night, and on Tuesday morning she died, just unexpectedly. She was taken to the hospital. She was quite ill. She had Parkinson's, so it wasn't like completely out of the blue. But I was in Europe. I was in Italy, actually. And I didn't feel that I needed to come back for her funeral. My father was a little bit mentally diminished and wasn't that clearly tuned in to who was where. My sister didn't feel I needed to come back, so I didn't. I was in Italy, though, so we didn't tell anyone that my mother had died, because I think all my Italian friends would have disowned me forever if they had known that I didn't drop everything and fly back to the U.S. They wouldn't have understood. But I had a question for Swamiji, because I had a respectful and a positive relationship with my mother. But I was born from my spiritual family. And I have a close tie with my siblings, especially my sister who's on this path. But my parents were good people. But I didn't want to have a really deep tie with them. I don't mean that to sound hard-hearted, because it isn't. But you all know we have different levels of involvement with different people in our lives. Merely because we share biological characteristics doesn't mean that we're also deeply connected. Sometimes you have children, and sometimes they turn out to be your friends, and sometimes they turn out just to be your children. If they're your friends, when they grow up, you all stay together. If they were just your children, then they go on about their business. And you can mourn it all you want to, but we have different karma with different people. And often devotees really live incarnate for their spiritual family. And the rest of it is just what you do until you get there. So when my mother died, I asked Swamiji, I said, what is my responsibility to her now? And it was a different kind of question. If I go on now without thinking about her all the time, will she know? In other words, I don't want to hurt her feelings. You know, I'd been very attentive not to hurt her feelings. And Swami smiled. It was a very sweet response. I said, will she remember me? And he said, when a person like your mother, he said, there'll be a vague memory of this world, but the details will very quickly fade away. And so he was saying, you've done your duty, you can now go on. I believe she stayed very tight with my father, though. My father lived 2 more years. This is just, by the way, about death, which is so interesting. My father lived 2 more years. The day after my father, and during those 2 years, I could never really think of my mother without feeling very uncomfortable. And I wasn't sure why. After my father died, I could contemplate my mother with perfect equanimity. And my brother and sister, who are both very sensitive souls, intuitive souls, the day after my father died, the three of us were together, and all three of us had exactly the same experience. We had never spoken to each other. For 2 years, my mother was agitated because my dad wasn't with her. And somehow when she got my dad with her, she could let us all go at that point. And that's how it's been ever since, because the karmas are different, you see. 56 years they had together, they were very close. Karmas are different. But the karma that we have with highly spiritual beings whose existence in their physical body is really quite incidental to their incarnation. I met Swamiji when he was in his early 40s, and I had, as most of you have heard me say, literally an instantaneous recognition. He walked into the room, and I knew that this was the one I'd been looking for. Well, I didn't know I'd been looking for one. I knew this is what I had been looking for. Just like that. He hadn't even spoken. And that evening, I just felt his consciousness without boundaries. And 40-some years later, people would often ask me, is Swamiji different now than he was when you met him? And I had to say for me that what I met in the first moment was what I saw in the last time I saw him. It was exactly the same. His way of presenting himself went through very great transformation. At the beginning, he was quite veiled, because he just had many reasons, but he was very veiled. At the end, he just let his consciousness flow, and it was recognizable to almost everyone. But all the physical that he went through, where most of us are defined, we live as youths, we lived in the middle of our lives, we raise children, we have relationships, and we're always being defined by it. But for Swamiji, it was a responsibility. He had a responsibility to be a disciple. He had a responsibility to do this work. He had a responsibility for all of us to really be an instrument for us of Master. And above all, his responsibility was to show what it means to be a disciple. It was a very interesting incarnation in that respect, which is one of the reasons he kept his consciousness veiled. His responsibility was not to be a guru in the sense that, I'll put it this way, the game was played in America at that time where everybody was proclaiming themselves. I was having my hair cut the other day and the woman asked me, because she knows somewhat of what I'm doing, oh, you've been practicing all this for a long time. Are you enlightened? She said like that. And I said, oh, heavens, no. And she said, well, that's honest. Because that's what so many people say. My favorite line in that respect was a man who said, I used to meditate, but now I'm just enlightened. But Swami's role with us was to show us how to be a disciple. He was fully qualified as a guru. And in the end of his life, it became very clear. And he didn't pretend anymore. But it wasn't his responsibility. His responsibility was to cast all light upon this line of gurus and upon his own master, Yoganandaji. Because that's what's needed at this age, is devotion and respect. And we do not know how to be disciples, especially in America. Actually, in India, they don't know so well either. Nobody knows anymore. It's gotten all mixed up with all kinds of levels of misunderstanding. So Swami had to show us what it meant to be a disciple, which is to understand that I do not act for myself, for myself, and as I evolve, I do not act as myself. The whole goal of our lives is to merge our consciousness so completely with the source of our inspiration that inspiration flows without the slightest interruption through us. And his life also was to show us that it's not always smooth sailing. What happens so much with these great souls, and has already begun to happen with Yogananda's life, actually the movie Awake really helped. Because the movie Awake was done as a documentary. To my mind, as an actual tribute to Yogananda, it fell very, very far short. But as a very interesting documentary, it actually did a very good job of showing us this kind of historical progression of what this great soul had to face in America and how many difficulties he had. I mean, he built all of his headquarters, Mount Washington, and he had brought this childhood friend over to be his virtual equal in the work. And then that man betrayed him. I mean, not only betrayed him in that he took all the money and left, but he also then took him to court and cast scurrilous accusations at Yogananda that were all published in the Los Angeles Times. I mean, Yogananda's reputation was ruined at that point. And even though ultimately the case, he lost the case. The scurrilous accusations were mostly disproved, but all you have to do is print them in the paper. And if you put them in a lawsuit, as we well know, if you put them in a lawsuit, you're not subject to the libel laws. And every newspaper in the world can just print it as an allegation in the lawsuit. And whatever happens later is just lost. But what was shown by that, and after that was all done, Yogananda just wiped the dust of America off his feet and went down to Mexico. He had just had it with this country. I mean, nothing like that could ever have happened in India. He just went to Mexico and made it very clear that he didn't know if he was ever coming back. And so he had to spend time there and reevaluate. Now you would say he was a master. Why did he have to do that? Well, when a great soul incarnates, they take on the conditions of this world. And they don't just not live here. What kind of an example would that be? Well, Master decided in the end that he would come back. And he did, but he lived very differently after that. He no longer went out on his public lectures. He was no longer that kind of figure. He just settled in his ashram and waited for his disciples to come, began to write, began to nourish their lives. Well, Swami Kriyananda, as I was starting to say, the great figures, their lives get whitewashed. And they come and they just chant Om, and the destined ones come and they touch them on the chest and they go into samadhi, and then it's over. And then what are we supposed to do with that example? I mean, we can certainly feel that consciousness and be inspired, but our lives tend not to work like that, do they? So someone like Swami Kriyananda, who was himself spiritually free, but he was letting the karma run, that's what they say. I believe he was a Jivanmukta, and there was I don't understand how this works, but there's a little karma left that they allow to run, so that they will keep having to incarnate to help us. Although this was his last life, this time he finished it. This time he became a siddha. That's what Master told him. It's over for you. But there was karma running, and again, I don't understand. I really don't understand how that works. But things had to happen, and there were so many things that happened. Just the same kind of things that happened to all of us. Enormous financial troubles, betrayals, women who were not nice in relation to him, you know, loving aspirations that were disappointed, lawsuits, scandal, scurrilous journalism, ill health, name it like this. And so Swami had to participate in all of that. And he was by nature, an extremely open person. I'm in the process of gathering the material to write a book about all these years. So I've been reviewing and reviewing and reviewing. Swami, he wrote, you know, dozens and dozens of letters. I don't just mean private letters, but letters that were just sent out to everyone. Some of them are on the internet, some of them are not. And he never held back anything. He would say, you know, I felt so discouraged. I was almost more than I could handle. Right in the middle of all the lawsuit stuff, all of a sudden it turns out that our publications business has gone $700,000 in debt, which was a lot of money anyway, but was even more 25 years ago. And Swami just, he left everything and he just went to Hawaii for about 10 days. And he just sat there and he just writes very openly about it. You know, it was almost more than I could handle. All those years of effort, all that time thinking finally something was secure, and it had been held back from him. He didn't know what was happening. And all of a sudden, there it is. But what did he do every single time? Well, he had that characteristic devil breath. Just let all the tension out of your body. And then just look at the problem and just come back and put one foot in front of the other again. And he would say, you know, this is discouraging to me. Or he would write, you know, this week he would write about tremendous freedom. That what does it matter? God is with us. We're just doing his work. If we lose it all, what do we care? And then a month later, it was almost more than I could bear. Because you see, all of it is true. This is the picture of how we really live, which is our self-realization is not just a straight line. We don't just start at the bottom of the hill and just march to the top, and then that's the story. It's an uphill, and we finally get to a peak, and then we go down the other side, and the valley on the other side was deeper than anything we've ever been in before. And then we come up again and we finally, how many times, this is it. You know, I finally got it done. That at least I can cross off my list. Wham, right in the back of the head again. And so it's not like, it doesn't help us that much. Just have this very false picture, because then what happens is we think there's something wrong with us, don't we? We think, I must not be doing this properly. But when you see, even this is the life of great souls, and it isn't really how many times you fall, nor does it matter really how far you fall, because you just don't know. Swami, once when he was talking about some of the very great souls who caused him a lot of grief in his life, and he said, you know, one looks at them and thinks, how can such a great soul have such a great fault? He said, well, it may only be, as he put it, he said, it may just be one little strata of their nature. There may be one deep hole and everything else is resolved. But you're still living in that one deep hole. And then it has to be brought up again. Now, where does this leave us? Swamiji, in something that he wrote, it touched me very deeply. He talked about a certain circumstance of his life that had really, really hurt him, hurt his heart, broke his heart in a certain sense. Just aspiration for other people, extreme unkindness. It was very painful. And he felt the pain of it. But on the other side of it, the pain was happening on one level, and then, as he put it, on another level, he was very free. And he said, "Master is very pleased by my freedom." And this particular Gita verse that we were reading today, I've heard that for so many years, you know, give God your failure. And I've heard Swamiji say on many occasions that God is pleased when you give him your successes, but he's more deeply pleased when you give him your failures. And I have never been able quite to understand that. I just couldn't quite feel it. But I realized that the word in there is freedom. The word that is the key word is not success or failure. The word is freedom. That we have brought ourselves. Swamiji came willingly, Master came willingly to help us. But the rest of us have come because we wanted to. Or let me phrase it differently. We were compelled by our karma to be here. You know, we did not have a choice about whether we would incarnate or live this life. Because the magnetic forces, as it said in that reading today, we're attracted to this consciousness. We're attracted to our physical bodies and to all the sensuality that can involve and all the intimacy and the people and the things and the experiences that we wanted. Everything has its attracting power. And we have been attracted to these things. We wanted to be Americans here. We wanted to live in Silicon Valley. We wanted to have our little devices, you know. We really wanted these things. And we can rail against them, but we really wanted to be here. And we couldn't have not done it. But we can also live on many different levels, you know. And there's another level where the soul, so to speak, the superconscious, just watches the other part of us play it out. We need to live with ourselves a little bit like we need to be our own parents watching our own children. You know, you're watching your children and it's painful, isn't it, sometimes? I don't have children of my own, but I have young people in my life. I have a nephew that I watch. There he is, having to make his way, and it's really sometimes more agonizing than if you were doing it yourself. It's not as if you can just stand back and say, well, it's their life. You know, you feel it with every particle of yourself, and you want in every way to make it different. But you can't make it different, can you? Because the karma has to run, the lessons have to be learned. And that's really how we're watching ourselves, isn't it? Oh my, look at her, look what she's falling for this time. You know, look at the pain, the inevitable pain that she has to go through now. You know, all these karmic debts that have to be paid, all these things that have to ultimately be balanced, every misunderstanding, poor thing. There you are, except it's me, or you, but a little piece of it can always just stand back and realize there's a whole other story running here. And even just like you're in a movie, the movie will just take you. We saw this movie once. It was so intense. It was about the people, the French resistance in the Second World War, the Dutch resistance, and it was so intense. And we were all in a group of us in the movie, and somebody sort of poked me like that and said, "Breathe, you'll find it easier." And I realized, you know, it was like that. And then as soon as they said that, oh yeah, we're just in a movie. I can just breathe, you know. We can come out of here eventually. That's how we have to live our own life. That was how Swamiji always was. And it manifested in the most interesting way. Even at the worst of times, we were always making jokes. Always making jokes. We laughed our way through some of the most horrific circumstances. I mean, really horrific. Just lies and accusations and financial difficulties, everything. We just laughed our way through it. Not every minute, that's true, but a lot. And what is humor? I asked Swamiji once, because he asked me a very simple question. We were actually standing on the balcony in Hawaii when he was working on the editing the path. We were looking down at the swimming pool, And he said, what's all that white, what's all that foam or all that white there? And I said, white caps. You know, it was a swimming pool about this big, you know, like ocean waves. And it was just, but it came out of my mouth just like that, just a silly answer. I said, Swamiji, what is humor? Where does that come from? He said, to a certain extent, it's a spiritual quality, humor is. Because it's the ability to take one step back and just see things from a wholly different perspective. I mean, that's what freedom is, isn't it? It's just to be able to take one step back and see it from a wholly different perspective. When we're right in it, there's no possibility of a joke. You joke at your peril when somebody's really right in the middle of it. Even to give them what we call true but highly irrelevant spiritual advice is not welcome. Oh, this will pass, you know. Not what we want to hear. But Swamiji lived his life for us in absolute openness. You know, you knew yesterday, today, and tomorrow everything that he'd been through. But underneath it, there was always that pulse. And that pulse was, we're really here for God. We're really here for Guru. We're really here to purify our consciousness, to be an instrument of that inspiration, because the end of that story is bliss. And that's the only story worth living, isn't it? And the sooner we get to the end, the more joyful we will be. But every chapter along the way, God-given, for one reason, so that the conclusion will be all the more glorious when we finally reach it. God bless you.